Hello, this is the Moonfest Destiny podcast, number 9. Moonfest Destiny is a novel I wrote, subtitled The Rough and Ready Balloon Invasion of the Lunar Peninsula of Texas. My name is Peter Gelman. I will read chapter 8 to you. Prince President Franklin Stove. Tick, 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 tick. Aye, sir, metal, and porcelain, and wood. I am an automaton, like the German kind. Who plays chess? He suggested hopefully to Sergeant Mallory as he waited for the gate of Fort Slowpoke to open. Maybe you have heard of the one, tick, named Prince Millig, the Rage of Vienna. And of New York, tick, and a Turkish sage, Bafadophilus Mazel, whose predictions always come true, tick, but that one was a fraud. There was a trained monkey inside, pulling its puppet wires, tick. What pulled the monkey's wires? Tick, tick, tick. I am the real McCoy, I am, and native manufacture. He rapped his knuckles against his head. It rang like a bell. Tick. Now, myself, I am a metal fellow, but I am chicken at heart. Tick. Let us in. Let us in, sir. My boiler pressure drops. Must feed the fire some sinfully black coal. You from a circus? Asked the sergeant, walking sideways, saber unsheathed. Tick, 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 in a manner of speaking, sir. In a manner of speaking, this metal fellow came all the way from Washington City as a gift from the cabinet. Did I neglect to mention that Secretary Marcy secured my services for your behalf? Vice President Dallas sends his howdy-do, too. Tick, tick, tick. The Philadelphian mechanic sent me to Senator Calhoun in order that I might, by means of my elastic tongue, and press on him the logical and reasonable necessity of protecting the national genius for fabrication with protective tariffs. Tick, 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 tick. The senator promptly bid me to mimic his oratory on the benefits of a Greek democracy. Thither he sent me until I publicly predicted his death by catarrh in 1850. And a Negro emancipation 13 years after. Tick, tick, tick. He packed me in a crate and sent me as a goodwill gift to Senator Webster, whom I informed upon his immediate inquiry that never would he be president, that the Union will soon suffer secessionitis. Tick, tick, to which he roared, "Tell that to young America." And so he arranged an audience with President Polk. Tick, a tick. I told Mr. Polk that war will come on the 2nd of May, that the USA would be victorious, and tick, 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 Whig victory in 48 with General Taylor. Mr. Polk frowned at this, but Secretary Marcy and Vice President Dallas bent at either ear, and tick, tick, bid me balloon to the moon. And General Taylor's camp with all due alacrity. Mind you, Marcy added, all due alacrity. Ah, here we are, he added, for the gate had dropped forward, becoming a drawbridge over the briars and bramble-filled ditch. Sergeant Mallory, called my brother's voice from the open gate, get that stranger and his mule inside on the double. Aye, sir, called the sergeant. You may go ahead, Mr. Metal. Tick, Prince, corrected the stranger. President Stove. A little steam escaped from his nostrils, and he lurched forward. Borginis, get inside. Rawlings, it's your watch, the sergeant said. My sentry duty finally ended. I led the procession of metal, mule, and men. We clomped over the wooden drawbridge. A soldier's boots and ankles stood over us, on top the gate's crossbeam, the rest of him obscure in silhouette. The lieutenant and a platoon of armed men waited behind. "Close it up," Kelly bawled. "Fetch the captain, Corporal. You, light a lantern and bring it here." The men rushed and heaved on the drawbridge pulleys. It swung, wobbling up, groaned, and clomped shut. The spindly drummer boy ran back with a light swinging, his shadow leaping all around. Captain George Washington Sewell strode behind him. Prince President looked funny in the light. He was tall, even taller with his stovepipe hat, and his face was handsome, even proud, but false, like a mask. He stood solemnly, ticking pleasantly, stroking the square trimness of his porcelain beard. "He says he's Prince somebody or other," saluted Mallory. "He says he's made of metal." "He's an educated automaton, sir, so he says. A surgeon. Sent by the president, too. And, sir, he's brought us a mule." "We can use his mule, that's certain," mused Captain Sewell. "As to him being metal or not, I don't care if a man is a pope-kissing mick, heathen mandarin, black rascal, drunken Injun, or rag-picking hebe, as long as he's American. But right now, none of us are worth our weight in cow pies lest we get those bomb-proofs finished. Take his mule to the pit right now. Maybe now we can complete it by daylight, God willing. Give it with my compliments to Captain Mansfield." Puffing his long cigar furiously, he examined the stranger up and down and all around. "You," he called, pointing his cigar. "So you're a prince, eh? So you're not an American, eh?" Captain Dixon Miles climbed down from gun platform 4 on the other side of the gate and came to stand beside Captain Sewell, arms folded. Old Sock ran over with a crystal of toddy, Miles' habitual indulgence. "Tick, tick, tick, tick. On the contrary," bowed the metal man, his stovepipe describing an arc of smoke and ash. "I am of Philadelphian manufacture. Modified and improved in New Orleans. Tick, my name is Prince. The great United States Constitution," observed Captain Sewell with an unfriendly expression, "says no citizen can hold an aristocratic title like king or lord or prince." Perhaps he was thinking this metal man a spy of the great powers. After all, they had all tried to make a dirty deal with Texas when it was its own republic. They all wanted to steal crescents from the moon on the grounds that the moon owed them millions. Only a few years ago, in 39, a whole passel of great power sent, as a banker's warning, a joint stock balloon fleet to bombard the fortress of Fracastorius Crater. They even went so far as to knock down the northern wall of Fracastorius with a new kind of cannonball, a hollow iron shell stuffed with powder, lit by a fuse. Beside the infamy of experimenting their terrible new weapon on the little moon, I wouldn't neglect to mention that dirty trick Great Deimos played on us, making a deal with some lunar general for the rights to dig the tunnel of Heraclitus, even as we waited for a president to stay in power long enough to exchange diplomatic niceties. Thus, a monarch stole the fast route to Venus from a republic, showing the nature of Martian despotism, conquest and meddling all around the inner spheres, not to mention unfair monopolies of Saturn, silk, rubber, and spices. Although they felt free to shoot down our slaver balloons in orbit around Jupiter, although some folks like Corporal Hernani Klager thought our own Navy wasn't doing enough to enforce Congress's law against that kind of import, it just wasn't fair that the monarchs got all the spoils of that sphere. But the point is, this outer sphere meddling in inner sphere affairs really got our Monroe Doctrine dander going. No doubt them pesky lunars wanted to use our Monroe Doctrine and poke corollary to it against us in our legitimate defense of Texas. No doubt they wanted to set the mighty Union Jack balloon fleets against our own, in which case the little moon in the middle might be spared. Wasn't this metal fellow a spy then? Thank you for listening. This is a free podcast, so I hope you will forgive my imperfect reading. This novel is available on Kindle for 99 cents. I believe that's 0.75 pounds and less than 1 euro. Okay, so I want to talk about the historical references here. When I was in Mexico, I didn't have reference to full historical documents. And there's one error. At the time, I thought the amendment to the U.S. Constitution regarding titles of nobility had passed, but it has not. It's known as the Titles of Nobility Amendment. And I checked good old Wikipedia. It was proposed in 1810, and it says, if a citizen of the United States shall accept, claim, receive, or retain any title of nobility or honor, or shall, without the consent of Congress, accept and retain any present, pension, office, or emolument of any kind whatever from any emperor, king, prince, or foreign power, such person shall cease to be a citizen of the United States, and shall be incapable of holding any office of trust or profit under them, or either of them. The United States Senate approved the measure by vote of 19-5 in 1810. It was then adopted by the United States House of Representatives with a vote of 87-3 the next week. After its passage in the Congress, the amendment was presented to the state legislatures for ratification. There is speculation that the Congress proposed the amendment in response to the 1803 marriage of Napoleon Bonaparte's younger brother, Jerome, and Betsy Patterson of Baltimore, Maryland, who gave birth to a boy for whom she wanted aristocratic recognition from France. The child named Jerome Napoleon Bonaparte was not born in the United States, but in Great Britain on July 7, 1805. Nevertheless, he would have held U.S. citizenship through his mother. Another theory is that his mother actually desired a title of nobility for herself, and indeed, she is referred to as the Duchess of Baltimore in many texts written about the amendment. The marriage had been annulled in 1805, well before the amendment's proposal by the 11th Congress. Nonetheless, Representative Nathan Macon of North Carolina is recorded to have said, when voting on the amendment, that he considered the vote on this question as deciding whether or not we were to have members of the Legion of Honor in this country, and it was ratified by 12 state legislatures, rejected by 3, New York, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. South Carolina went both ways. And technically, the amendment is still subject to being approved by the nation state lawmakers since there's no deadline. So from 1810, it's still a possibility. Okay, and also, the text makes reference to canal. There were a lot of British and French attempts to find a place to make a canal through Central America to between Atlantic and Pacific. And what the Wikipedia, again, thank you Wikipedia, the pastry war. When, okay, so what am I going to read here? In 1838, a French pastry cook, Romantel, claimed that his shop in a district of Mexico City had been ruined by looting Mexican officers in 1828. He appealed to France's King Louis-Philippe. Coming to its citizens' aid, France demanded 600,000 pesos in damages. This amount was extremely high when compared to an average workman's daily pay, which was about 1 peso. In addition to this amount, Mexico had defaulted on millions of dollars worth of loans from France. The diplomat gave Mexico an ultimatum to pay, or the French would demand satisfaction. When the payment was not forthcoming from President Anastasio Bustamante, the king sent a fleet under Rear Admiral Charles Baudin to declare a blockade of all Mexican ports from Yucatan to the Rio Grande to bombard the Mexican fortress of San Juan de Ulca. I don't know how to pronounce that, Uya, and to seize the port of Veracruz. Virtually the entire Mexican Navy was captured at Veracruz By December 1838, Mexico declared war on France. That was 1838. Okay, and one other thing I'd like to mention is that characters in this novel are living in 1846, and they don't necessarily speak of other ethnicities with the same respect that we demand as proper in today's world. I'm hoping that you understand that. Next chapter, Metal Man will talk more about himself, and the politics of the women in the fort will become apparent. Thanks for listening.